Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you are listening to the web version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Ridwan Sakhija. He's a professor of physics and materials science here in our department at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Ridwan.
Hi, Dave. Pleasure to be here.
Now, Ridwan, you are a computational physicist. You've got a lot of different things going on. I'm always struck by every time we talk that you've got multiple irons in the fire. So kind of go through the list of all the things you're doing right now.
Yeah, so currently we are working on five separate projects. These are projects that are supported by the federal government. And one of them is from the Department of Energy. Three are from National Science Foundation. And the last one is with NASA.
Now, all of them are sort of themed around a particular topic. So talk about the theme of all of them.
Yeah, so the overarching sort of a theme with all of these projects, these are computational material science project. So let me just briefly, what that really means is that we are using computers as a way for us to evaluate the structure and property relationship of materials. Now, of course, then you would ask what kind of materials that would be suitable to do computational. So with different projects, we are aiming at advancing different type of materials for specific applications. So for the Department of Energy program, the goal there is to look for newer materials that can be used for turbine engine, which is and the purpose there is to raise the operating temperature of this turbine engine. And in doing so, it will increase the thermal efficiency of the material. So we use computational as a way for us to design or to understand essentially what type of mechanical properties that this would entail as you operate these turbine engines at very high temperature. The other three projects are supported by National Science Foundations. And again, the central theme here is to understand structure property relationship. So first NSF project is to understand the relationship between structure and property of what we call the advanced ceramics that is also to be used at ultra high temperature. And we use computational as a way to understand the stability of this, what we call the diborites, which is one of the ceramics. The second one is looking at also another ceramics, but it's meant for body armor protection. So it's a different type of ceramics being used, not necessarily at high temperature, but the process to make that ceramics, that's where we use computational as a means to understand. Of course, all of this in collaboration with the experimentalists. And the third one is to, another ceramics, or I should say oxide, where we're looking at the process or the materials process involved in producing a thin film, and in this particular one, for electronics. So you can see there's a broad range of materials that we can actually analyze, starting from structural materials like a DOE projects or one of the NSF project, and into a more like a functional for electronics, body armor protections, again, using computational as the sort of the means for us to understand that.
So before we delve into one particular project deeply, let's talk about the broad process again. So a lot of times people will say it's a solution in search of a problem, but in your particular case, some of the time it sounds like there's actually specific sort of, let's call it, classes of problems that people have. So when you get involved in a project like this, how does that work? Do you know some experimentalists? Are you talking to people? Do you just have your nose to the ground, so to speak? Do you get whiffs of different things that are interesting? So how do you get drug in and become part of a project like that?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. I mean, because, when we people think about computational material science, they think of essentially almost like an alchemy, looking at all these new materials, new compounds to look for. But that's also that's a bigger, one big portion of computational material science. What we're doing essentially is a little bit more toward relationship or establishing a synergy with experiments. So I just happen to be, I'm actually an experimentalist as well.
I know that.
Yeah, so I, speaking of that, so I have a lot of collaboration actually with fellow experimentalists. I call myself, I still consider myself an experimentalist. And so there is to me, that's the biggest satisfaction actually, is being able to collaborate with a lot of these very, very established researchers that are with a very specific goal in terms of aiming their research in advancing a particular type of applications. And in that, we use computational as a way to help them out. And of course, in a way, it's also help ourselves.
So let's think of an example. For example, in silicon, for a long, long time, silicon dioxide was the preferential oxide that was used in semiconductor manufacturing. I don't think that's true anymore. If I'm not mistaken, it's hafnium oxide now. Is it true that much of the time the materials, the new materials get invoked because you're pushing the envelope on the performance of things and you need to find materials that are better suited to exploiting those new parameters? Is that
that's a very, very good point. Yes. So oftentimes, you usually start with the existing materials as a way to sort of your benchmark, if you want to call it that way. And then you look at actually the needs to go beyond that, either to improve the thermal efficiency, to improve the performance, and so on and so forth. So a lot of these projects are actually the main motivation, typically, is because you want to improve beyond what the limit that the materials that the current materials can actually offer to you. And in doing so, you either, and usually you do this in conjunction, you explore the through experiments, for example, viable options for you to be able to find a suitable replacement, or in this case with our work with this with the experimentalists, we work them as a way to look for again another viable option, but by means of computational.
Okay, so let's think about the turbines, because you've got Department of Energy where people are interested in turbines.
Correct, yes.
So the turbine blades are inside this big jet engine of some kind or another.
Right.
And so what's the point that you're trying to make? I think you talked about temperature. So temperature, you don't think you'd like things to be hot, but amazingly enough, in some cases, it's better if things run hot. So lead us through how this whole idea behind modifying the materials in a turbine blade would come about.
Well, yeah. So if you think about turbine engine as a way for essentially being able to convert the combustion that comes out from the fuel, you can think of basically the higher the temperature of that the turbine engine can sustain, that basically means that it has the ability to convert that, think of that actually like a chemical reactions into a mechanical energy. Okay, so the higher you can raise the temperature this turbine can sustain within the jet engine, the higher the efficiency is.
Right.
Yeah. So from that note, oftentimes what is happening is that as you raise the temperature, the current technologies basically is the following: you have a limit essentially of what's the maximum temperature that a turbine engine can sustain. Now, for you to be able to raise the temperature, typically what you have to do is you have to force very active cooling system inside this turbine engine. But that requires energy, right?
Right.
So those energy actually, in essence, you took that away from the energy that comes from the
right.
chemical reactions. So in some way, at some point, you can see that the efficiency is going to be degraded even if you can push the higher temperature.
Unless you have a material that can just sustain. So now, what's going to happen when you talk about mechanical properties? In this particular case,
yes,
you're talking about a metallic alloy. So talk about that metallic alloy and also the specific mechanical properties. Is it the stiffness? Is it that you don't want it to go soft? What kinds of things are you looking to improve? And what kind of alloys are you talking about here?
Right. So again, I'm going to go back to the reason why we do computational. Typical super alloy, we call it that. It's made of a nickel, and it is mixed with at least 7, 8, oftentimes 10 other elements. And these are materials that would have to sustain not only the low temperature, but obviously during operating temperature, which can be about 1,000 degrees Celsius. You have to be able to maintain the integrity of these materials. Remember, this is essentially, you can think of these materials being exposed at 1,000 degrees, but has to endure a lot of mechanical conditions, shear stress, and so on and so forth. So there are requirements, basically, for this turbine engine as far as their mechanical strength. And oftentimes, as you go to higher temperature, this mechanical property typically would degrade or would be lower. So what we are aiming at, actually, is to looking at how to sustain this mechanical strength at higher temperature. So we're thinking about, if you think about basically around where the operating temperature of typical turbine engines. Now, I should mention also that this is not just for aerospace application. It can also be used for power plants. That temperature is a little bit lower, but nonetheless, it's still at elevated temperature. Now, I should mention, however, one more thing, actually. The beauty or the strength of using atomistic modeling is that you can go inside this material and looking at what happened when you apply mechanical stress to it, what type of degradation, what kind of deformation, essentially, that would take place as you apply this mechanical stress.
Now, ultimately, experimentalists will have to work on these. And so on the front end, what you're doing is when you talk about 11 constituents to an alloy, you're essentially saying that to do experiments on that from scratch would basically take the experimentalists so very, very long as to be not useful, and that conceivably computational work will narrow things down? Is that the
yes.
idea?
I mean, that is absolutely true. Obviously, as you can just imagine, if you have 11 elements to optimize, you have a huge dimensional problem, basically, in terms of being able to locate the optimum composition, for example. And computational, especially with the way we have access essentially to national lab that would provide us with the allocation for supercomputer time, we would be able to actually explore this rapidly and without the time scale that an experiment will have to do.
Right. Now talk about the methodology you use to explore that space. You don't just randomly pick any particular point in this 11-dimensional space. You pick things, you said it's mostly nickel, so you pick things around the nickel preference, but then how do you decide? Do you just do anything, or do you have a specific, very formulaic way that you search the space?
Yeah. So the way we approach this problem is obviously you start with an existing materials. So the existing materials would have a different constituent inside that would gear toward a specific we call it phases, basically, the one that would reinforce the materials, the one would be the matrix of the materials. And then as we explore this compositional space, there's an underlying information with respect to what each of the elements, for example, tend to do. Now, I should mention, however, which is actually a very good point also, we are using artificial intelligence as a way to expedite this search. So one of the things, actually, the biggest advantage nowadays is you can combine not only the aspect of computational material science, which to aid your experiments, but also use AI as a way to help accelerate that design space that and narrowing it down to optimal condition. Yeah.
If that were going to be true, then you would have to decide. You'd have to make some decisions as to what makes you happiest. So do all the properties improve at the same time, or do you have some properties that improve while you search the space and then other properties that actually get worse?
Well, that's the more reason why we use actually AI for that. Because as you can think of, like, actually, if I'm in n-dimensional space,
right,
any movement I made obviously would affect one property or the others, and that necessarily always complementary, right? So in that sense, there's a body of knowledge, obviously. Take an example. One of the elements is chromium. We know, for example, chromium helps improve the oxidation resistance. Okay, so of course you can think of, well, maybe I can just improve the chromium a lot more. But there is a consequence for that. When you add a lot of chromium, you may actually introduce maybe brittle components inside the materials. So there's a mechanical sort of aspect that you have to consider as well. So there's a lot of this interplay between this element that you have to have include when you make the design. And this is why actually the computational becomes a much more a powerful tool to accelerate that discovery.
Now, some people would think, and so we're going to talk about students in a moment, but some people would think to themselves, well, you're just letting the computer do the work. And at some level, that's true. But the guidance, the interplay between experimental work and telling the computer what is and is not important. Talk about how students, because most people think you go into a physics or a material science program, you open books and you just memorize things, which of course is not the case. Talk about the way that students are going to be part of this process. I know you have a lot of students. And how what they're going to learn, the kinds of things they're going to learn, and how this will inform their future as scientists.
Yeah, I mean, so you raise a very good point about students, actually. I would say, quite frankly, in addition to having the ability to collaborate with a great deal of my colleagues all throughout the United States, different universities, a very active research university, the second, if not actually probably the first one, joy for me is to be able to train my students on the ability of all kinds of these computational skills. Why? Because one of the things that actually you want to be able to accomplish, especially at our place, a mid-level university, is to be able to train them to be competitive, right? To be competitive in industry, as well as if they were to pursue a PhD program elsewhere, for example. So having the ability to, and this is not just necessarily on the graduate level, graduate students, but also undergraduate level, being able to immerse, having been able to introduce a lot of these computational aspects into our curricula, for example, and obviously in my research, they will become much more competitive in fact, one of the biggest joy to me, I gotta say, is when a student or an alumni came back to me and says, you know, Dr. Sakija, I'm glad that I took your course, talking about how to apply AI, for example, in material selections, because that seems to be one of the sort of the key point for me to get to be selected in a PhD program or on being able to land a job in industry. The power of computational is something that is unique in the sense that if you think about, for example, and I don't mean to be saying that experimental is necessarily cannot be done at our place. Of course, it can. But what is the beauty about computational is that when we use software, okay, when you use software, for example, to look at electronic structure or looking at property at the very, very small scale, that software is exactly the same software students at MIT,
right,
at Ohio State, at Berkeley, that would.
Right.
It's the same software.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is the beauty of this, which is we allow us to be, our student, to be at par in terms of at least their facility.
Right.
And
right.
That is something that actually I surely hope that we can actually sustain further at our place.
So talk about when a student gets trained on this, because I find something like this there's two things going on, perhaps, or maybe more. One is they have to learn how to specifically use the particular tools. There's all kinds of upfront knowledge you have to gain about how to use them.
That's correct.
But there's also this whole idea of how to interpret and look at a problem from beginning to end and think about the big picture and where the different pieces play a role. Which part is more difficult, in your opinion, for the students to master?
Well, that would depend on their background. That's correct. So one of the things that we do is that we do quite rigorous training, not just a matter of how to use, for example, the computational software. It's the background that would lay the, sort of the path or give the pathways toward looking at, you know, providing a sort of a broader picture of the actual problem that you're trying to solve, essentially. So that can be done. Frankly, actually, that's one of the things, actually, I'm quite grateful also for the university in our program, for example. We have a material science program here. Since I came here, you know, the department has adopted, for example, computational material science as one of the core course. And that really allows our student with fairly diverse backgrounds academically, they would be able to, you know, give the opportunity. They gotten the opportunity to look at these broader pictures because, yes, that is absolutely true. So it is sort of a balance, I would say, right, between those two, yeah.
Now, we're going to wind up here, but let's mention one other thing. You're going, I think, to Lawrence Berkeley Labs for a summer and talk about that program and what kinds of stuff you're going to do there.
Yeah, so this is one of the thing that I mentioned about AI is one of the sort of the biggest, and not just because they're sort of the, I guess, the hot topic. It is actually, it's quite transforming. In other words, I already mentioned to you that the fact that computational is very helpful, right? In other words, it was able to you to accelerate the discovery process or looking at relationship between structure and property. But it takes time. It takes resources for you to be able to even just to calculate one materials, right? You mentioned about the space, configurational space that is huge. So AI is immersing AI into the computational material science. That is actually the sort of the most sort of upcoming or anticipated way to do in the future. So my visit, I happen to be gotten this DOE visiting faculty program in collaboration with one of the UC Berkeley faculty, Dr. Christine Person. She's also the director of Materials Project as well as Molecular Foundry Lab at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. So I will be spending the whole summer, essentially, or close to that, in looking at how we can actually immerse this AI into these five projects that we are actually running here at MSU.
Now, is that going to be Zoom, or do you get to go to Berkeley?
I'm flying there, yeah.
Good. It would be sad to not be able to spend time in Berkeley.
Well, there is some limitation, obviously, as you know, because of our situation.
Sure.
So there is some limitation as far as visit and so on and so forth. But the plan is to be there and work with and collaborate with her group, yes.
Great. Well, Ridwan, I hate to say it, but we're out of time. Thanks for stopping by. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.